From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the years before the attacks on 9/11, the National Security Agency had been caught off guard. But in those years since, the journalist James Bamford says the agency has been quietly reborn. The final piece of all of this, Bamford says, is the Utah Data Center, a heavily fortified digital storage facility in Bluffdale, where this epic complex of servers can capture a septillion bytes of information that's so big no one has yet come up with a term for the next higher magnitude. Think of it this way. It's equal to 500 quintillion pages of text. Today in the program, James Bamford is joining us to talk about the data center in Utah and the NSA, its history, and what the scope of its operation could mean for fighting terrorism and personal privacy. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the years after the Cold War ended, and particularly in the 90s, the National Security Agency had been caught off guard. They weren't able to see coming the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa, or the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen, or, of course, the attacks themselves on 9/11. But in the years since, the journalist James Bamford says the agency has quietly been reborn, transformed. Bamford has been reporting on the NSA for more than 30 years now, and lately he's been writing about what he calls one of the final pieces of the NSA transformation, the Utah Data Center. By now you've heard about it. It's a heavily fortified digital storage facility in Bluffdale, where a massive complex of servers will be capturing an almost unimaginable amount of information from all forms of communication, Google searches and cell phone calls and emails, even, Bamford says, parking receipts and bookstore purchases. Today in the program, James Bamford is joining us to help us understand the scope and the scale of this epic effort to collect and store information. We're also discussing the obvious questions being raised about what Bamford calls the largest, most covert, and potentially the most intrusive intelligence agency ever created. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. James Bamford is a journalist who's been writing about the NSA, as I said, for more than 30 years now. He's the author of four books. The latest is called The Shadow Factory. He also wrote about the Utah Data Center for Wired magazine, and he's joining us today from NPR in Washington. James Bamford, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Really good to be here.
Well, so I mentioned you've been writing about this for now more than 30 years now. Can I ask, what got you started thinking about this? What got you started wanting to cover this agency?
Well, I was in law school. I wasn't too enthusiastic about practicing law. And so when I graduated, I really wanted to be a writer, and nobody'd ever written a book on NSA. I was very interested in the intelligence community, and there have been a number of books on the CIA. So I thought it was it'd be a good idea to write on NSA, which very few people had ever heard of, yet it was a very, very large, very important, and very technically oriented agency. So it took me about 3 years, and basically that's how I got started on it.
Yeah. And you stayed with it. One of the only journalists who's really focused their efforts in some way on the NSA. Do you think people are getting... I'm thinking about Edward Snowden's revelations, but there are other things, I think, that play into all of this these days. Do you think people have an understanding, basic sort of rank-and-file Americans, the scope of the National Security Agency?
I think there's people at NSA that really don't have a idea of the scope because it's so compartmentalized. In other words, people in one wing don't know what people in the other wing are doing, and people don't know what the people in the next room are doing. So it's a very secretive agency, and I certainly don't have a full grip on what the agency's doing, so I really don't think there's a lot of members of the public that have a good grip on what NSA is doing.
Yeah. We'll talk about the Utah Data Center here in a moment. I wanted you to give us a sense of the kind of the history of the NSA, because you've written about this. You say it was established as an arm of the Department of Defense. Really, it was after Pearl Harbor. So the idea was to prevent another surprise assault, which is ironic when you think about how the NSA has now kicked into another gear after it missed some of the signs leading up to 9/11. But talk about that. It starts really after Pearl Harbor in some way?
Well, if you want to really go back, it starts 1920. There was an organization that started up. It was called the Black Chamber. And it was the first civilian, very secret code-breaking organization. And it was in a four-story townhouse in Manhattan. And that was the beginning, basically, of NSA. And ironically, one of the big problems that Herbert O. Yardley, the head of the Black Chamber, had in 1920 was how to get the messages to analyze. At the time, instead of the internet, they had telegrams. Mm. Telegram companies were the internet of the day. And so he made secret requests, secret appeals to the heads of the different telegraph companies to give him access to the illegal access to the telegrams coming into, going out of, or going through the United States at the time. So the NSA began illegally getting access to domestic American communications as far back as almost 100 years. Mm. And then from there, the Black Chamber actually got shut down in 1929. But then it was started up again, a different organization basically, but doing the same thing just before World War II. And then during the war, the U.S. and the Allies were very successful in breaking codes, breaking the German Enigma code and the Japanese Purple code and so forth. So the idea was after World War II not to let all that talent and that that knowledge go fallow. So the idea was to put it together into, again, another civilian eavesdropping, code-breaking organization, and then join it with all the allied organizations, what they now call the Five Eyes, which is the Australians, New Zealanders, the British, the Canadians, and the United States are that make up this sort of worldwide eavesdropping, code-breaking family of agencies. And then in 1952, the actual NSA got its start with its headquarters and its very secret beginnings. It actually was, if you look at the beginning of it, almost every other agency, including the CIA and every other agency, is created in public. It goes through a series of hearings in Congress. There's bills that are submitted. It's a normal process, bureaucratic process for creating an agency. The NSA, however, is the only agency that didn't go through that. It was formed by a top secret memorandum signed by Harry Truman in 1952, and its existence was even kept secret from almost everybody. I think there may have been one or two people in Congress that were given a little bit of an idea that this organization existed, and even its name at the time was top secret. So it's had this very strange beginning, but the emphasis all along has been on super secret information and keeping virtually everything the NSA does a secret.
And we're talking about domestic surveillance, too. I mean, it seems like you get some sense that this is just information from foreign, but the domestic component has been an important part of the NSA, I guess.
Well, it has. It's always been an important part. It, in addition to Herbert Yardley and the Black Chamber illegally getting access to U.S. telegrams right after World War II, 1946, the predecessor to NSA then did this very same thing that Yardley did. They went, the head of the company, or rather the head of the agency, went to the presidents of the different companies, Western Union and so forth, and again, got them to illegally give NSA access to all these telegrams going through the U.S. And that lasted for 30 years until 1975 when it was discovered by this investigating committee in Congress called the Church Committee, named after Frank Church, Senator from Idaho.
Yeah.
And so you have this long string of illegally accessing U.S. communications in total violation of the law. So in 1978, Congress created what they hoped was a stopgap so it wouldn't happen again. Mm-hmm. And that was this very secret court. It was called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a court whose even its existence is supposedly secret, and everything it produces is secret. So it's a very strange thing. It's a very strange court, secret court for a secret agency, and nothing ever comes out. It's sort of like the bureaucratic equivalent of a black hole. Everything goes in and nothing comes out. Mm. And that's pretty much what happened. The NSA pretty much followed the law, or they did follow the law, basically right up until 2001 when George Bush decided to use the NSA to do illegal warrantless eavesdropping or wiretapping in the United States, completely bypassing the court, which, again, broke the law. And then what happened in 2008 was they reworked the law. The law was called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to weaken it. Mm. And then pretty much did basically the same thing that was done during the Bush years under warrantless eavesdropping, except now it had the basically the stamp of approval from Congress.
I want to talk about sort of head to the Utah Data Center in Bluffdale. I wanted to talk about encryption, too, because you see, this is sort of the one technology that is preventing what you call the sort of untrammeled government access to all this private digital data. That's it. I guess that's the essence of what's going to be happening in Bluffdale. Overcoming this last obstacle, or one of the last obstacles anyway, this idea of encryption. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, the biggest threat that NSA has is encryption, pretty much. If everybody went to encryption, it'd be in tough shape. It can break codes, but it just means all that more energy and focus and time and expense going into every single communications you want to break. So encryption is one solution. And what NSA is doing to overcome the encryption problem is at the same time they were building Bluffdale, the NSA's data storage facility in Bluffdale, they were also working on this enormous supercomputer down in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. That's where the U.S. Worked on the Manhattan Project, the secret operation to build the atomic bomb back in World War II. And this is sort of the atomic bomb equivalent of computers, the largest and fastest and most powerful computer ever created. And what they've done is they've developed a computer that will go, at this point, I think it's over 10 petaflops. That's a septillion operations a second. And they're working on this new computer now that I think will be ready in another year, probably a couple years. It will do what's known as an exaflop number of operations, which is the next magnitude higher than septillion, whatever that is, octocentillion or whatever it is. In other words, a very large number of operations. That's a second. That's in the basically the time it takes you to blink your eye. It'll do over a septillion operations a second. And but it will take up basically an entire warehouse, just full of what look like large storage closets that go from one side of the warehouse to the other. And because it's so, you know, if you have a laptop on your lap, it gives off heat. You can feel the heat on your knees and your thighs and your legs as it's sitting there. So you could think of what a computer the size of that will fill an entire warehouse, what kind of heat it would give off. And somebody estimated that they would need the same amount of cooling power for that computer as they needed in both towers of the World Trade Center. Wow. So you're talking about enormous power and heat and speed for this new computer that they're working on. Again, one of the key issues that they're focusing this on is the whole problem of encryption. And the faster you make a computer, the faster you're able to attack encryption systems. But you also need other things. You need, because encryption is very, very difficult to break. A lot of times it helps if you have a backdoor access to some aspects of it, or you find a fault in the system that you're able to exploit. So there's a lot of ways that they can go about breaking encryption.
Yeah. You reported last year the NSA believed it might be on the verge of breaking a key encryption algorithm. Do you any sense of where they might be on that?
Well, I don't know, because it's, again, among the things they keep the most secret is the their advances in code breaking. Mm-hmm. But that's the idea would be, if you were able to break some of these public encryption codes, then you can get access to tremendous amount of information, because every time somebody sends an email, or buys a plane ticket over the internet, or buys something from Amazon, that's all encrypted. You don't know it's encrypted. I mean, you're not physically doing anything to encrypt it, but it's automatically encrypted. So there's a lot of things that are encrypted that go over the internet, and being able to break some of these encryption systems would be very useful for NSA.
Yeah. You write about the groundbreaking for the facility here in Utah. In January of 2011 it was, and you said you'd sort of detected something of an anomaly there. No one from the Department of Homeland Security spoke from the lectern, for example. What did you find interesting about that?
Well, what was interesting was that they were the NSA or whoever in the Department of Defense or somebody there was saying that, oh, this is for computer security to protect American communications and all that. Mm-hmm. Actually, the agency that's in charge of protecting American communication, protecting American computers and so forth from attack, is the Department of Homeland Security. The NSA is only responsible for protecting government computers. So it was very odd that they were saying this is to protect everybody's computer when they didn't have anybody from the agency who was responsible for protecting everybody's computer. So obviously it had to do not with protecting everybody's computer, but with, you know, the things that have come out that I wrote about, storing all this data you're intercepting and breaking codes and all those kind of things. Now, they may do some cyber protection there or whatever, do some work dealing with cybersecurity, but that's not the main function of the
facility. That's not the point. Yeah, right. There are, you write about 1 million square feet here, a visitor control center. There is an administration building. There's security. There are these data halls, four of them you talk about, where all these servers are going to be stored. But one of the logistical aspects of the center is something you referred to a moment ago, the kind of the infrastructure designed to provide energy and to keep all of this equipment from really overheating. Because you say it's designed to be self-sustaining. I mean, there's a chiller plant. There's a power substation.
Well, for about 5 days. The worry is that if the electricity goes out, you don't want to lose all that, or you don't want the thing to melt down and, you know, become a big blob of metal. So they've got this emergency backup facility there. It's they've got one whole building that's nothing but batteries in case they needed that, and then they have tanks full of oil to power generators, generators, and so they're from what I've understood is that they're able to maintain it independently without outside electricity for maybe 5 days or maybe a week, something like that. But after that, as long as they could keep getting oil or whatever external fuel, mm-hmm. they might be able to keep it going. But the idea is that they feel that by 5 days or 7 days, they'd be getting the power back. So so a lot of that infrastructure there is for redundancy, to keep the operation going in case there is a massive power failure.
Give us a sense, James Bamford, of the potential amount of information that can be housed here in Utah. Because you've written about this. It's staggering, I think, is the word you used.
Well, sure. It's basically the largest data storage facility in the world. And when people think about how much you can store, a terabyte is a tremendously very large amount of storage capacity, a terabyte. But now we've squeezed a terabyte data storage down to the size where you could buy a Swiss Army knife where one of the blades is actually a terabyte of data, so you can stick it into your computer as a USB outlet to store data. So, and the NSA has been working on compressing data in secret. I mean, it has all these laboratories where they're trying to develop computers and techniques and so forth that's beyond the state of the art for the outside world. So whatever the outside world is, the NSA is several generations probably in advance of that. So the idea is that they can shrink or they can compress enormous amounts of data into a small area. So if you have the actual data storage area within that million square feet is 100,000 square feet, you can put an awful lot of data in there.
Mm.
You know, I in the book I or actually in the article I wrote a yottabyte. A yottabyte is the largest figure created. I mean, in terms of there is no term after yottabyte in terms of the amount of data. And a yottabyte, I did sort of calculate roughly into 500 quintillion pages of text, which probably would stretch from here to the next galaxy or something. I never did that calculation, but it's an awful lot of text.
Another dynamic you write about in your reporting is the agency has undergone this, what you describe as sort of the largest building boom in its history. And they're installing these monitoring rooms in U.S. telecom facilities. I wanted to talk about that. Because this is an interesting dimension that I think is going to disturb a lot of people.
Well, it should, yeah, because few people really know anything about it. I wrote about it in my book, The Shadow Factory, and I wrote about it in my Wired article, the one I did on Bluffdale. But other than that, there really hasn't been much that's come out on that. At least not up until now, with the Snowden revelations. It opens a new light on a lot of that information I wrote about. It's sort of, there are a lot of little pieces that were missing from the puzzle, and a lot of the data that's come out from Edward Snowden sort of fills in those little blanks or puts those pieces back in, or puts those pieces into the puzzle. Mm. So basically what it is the... After 9/11, let me back up. During the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and to some extent the early 90s, the way the NSA eavesdropped on communications around the world most of the ways was by building very large satellite dishes, 60, 90-foot satellite dishes that would collect the signals as they come down from the satellite. And once you're doing that, then you're picking up the phone calls, the email, everything that's going through the satellites, the communication satellites. And to get the uplink, they have satellites up in space. So that's how they did it for much of that the last half of the last century, mm-hmm. was by collecting telecommunications that went through the went through space and went through the air. Then the internet came along, and all of a sudden, the amount of bandwidth that was needed was just enormous. You just needed much more bandwidth because now all of a sudden, everybody has a computer, and everybody's trying to get online, and everybody's trying to get as much data as they want. Well, that was too much for all the satellites. So companies began building these big fiber optic cables around the world. you know, between the United States and Europe and the United States and Japan and all around the world. And these are very thick cables that contain these filaments, basically, and it's light that goes through there, photons. So that was a big problem for NSA.
Yeah.
Before, all they had to do was collect it as it fell down from space in the big dishes. Now they actually had to find ways to get it out of those cables. And the only way they could do that was by making secret agreements with the telecommunications companies that operated them. And the only way they could do that was by having them allow them to put a secret room in the facilities that where this information comes in and goes out.
So there are these secret listening rooms around the country where this NSA software is examining every email, every phone call, even tweets, I suppose. And they're doing it right now, for example, to all of us, in essence. Is that right?
Well, this is a fairly complicated topic. You can't really just reduce to a sentence or two. I mean, basically, that's true. It's a bit more complicated than that. But what the idea is, you put the filters. There's, say, half a dozen cables that come into the U.S. on the East Coast and half a dozen on the West Coast and a couple on the southern part of the United States. And so what you do is you find where a lot of this communications comes together and you put the secret room in there. And in the secret room is there's basically a copy of all this, the data that's flowing over these cables. And so this duplicate copy of the cables goes into the secret room, and in the room there are these computer devices. They're called NARIS machines. Mm-hmm. And what they are is basically just they look like computers. All the data goes in there, but the software is very, very fast. So it could, as this information is going by at the speed of light, it could analyze that data. It can see my email going by at the speed of light. It could tell where it's coming from, where it's going, what the name on the email is, and all that. It could even look at the content of the email to pick out a word or a phrase or a name, whatever it is they're looking for. So most of the data will go by without any problem. But if you happen to say the magic word, mm-hmm. whatever that happens to be, or send an email to a wrong address, and it doesn't have to be to Osama bin Laden or a terrorist. It could be just to, you know, somebody that they have on their watch list or somebody that's connected to somebody that's on the watch list. Then your data gets picked out and probably be stored for 5 years. That's one way of doing it. Another way that they have of doing it is by because if there's so much data that's going by at the speed of light, it's very difficult to have that software look at everything. So if there's a huge amount of data going through, what they do is they'll put it in a place like Bluffdale, which is one of the reasons for Bluffdale. And what they'll do is they'll have all this data going in, and there'll be enough room to store maybe a month's worth of this data. So as information comes in at one end, data that's, say, a month old will just disappear at the other end. So you'll always have a month's worth of data in this room or in the server or whatever. And then you can sort of take your time. Then you can search through this mammoth warehouse of data for whatever it is you're looking for, and you have a month to look for that data. Mm. I mean, that's even simplifying it to some degree, but that's sort of what it amounts to.
James Bamford is with us. He's the author of The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. He's also writing about the NSA for Wired Magazine. You can find links to his writing on our page, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist James Bamford, who has spent nearly more than 30 years actually exploring the National Security Agency. This fall, the NSA is set to begin operations from a massive complex in Bluffdale, a $2 billion project packed with servers and routers and databases. We're talking about the history of the NSA also with James Bamford, the scope of the operations and where that Utah facility fits in the picture. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Floyd, who's been waiting in Salt Lake. Floyd, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a comment, really, and it concerns the NSA in general and the Snowden affair more specifically, but the quote is from Benjamin Franklin, and it's given at my source for it is the Wikimedia quote source, but it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." And I would like, you know, just to kind of share that comment in the discussion here because it's my opinion that the framing on this issue in the popular media, again, this issue being the Snowden affair, is a little out of skew. We generally see it in terms of its security concerns, but I would rather that we saw it in terms of liberty, because it is liberty and justice that we pledge allegiance to. And when you compromise, if you will, liberty in favor of security, you are compromising the values and principles upon which the integrity of our system relies.
Yeah, I want to there is the give and take right there from Floyd. And Floyd, thanks for the call. And let me expand it a little bit, James Bamford, before I have you comment. Because there's an argument made by Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, in the wake of the Edward Snowden revelations. He said when he listens to this debate about, you know, all of the disclosures and the NSA, he says he wonders if those who are outraged about the NSA program and who defend Snowden are behaving as if 9/11 never happened. And he says that he himself will very reluctantly trade off the government using data mining to look for suspicious patterns in phone numbers called and email addresses. He said he's willing to do that for the NSA to prevent another 9/11. That is the trade-off as Friedman sees it. How do you respond to what Floyd had to say and Friedman's contention?
Well, I agree with Floyd 100%. I really like that quote. I've heard it many times from Benjamin Franklin, and I think he was right on target when he said it. And I think more people should realize it today. I mean, the problem with NSA is you don't really get either. You don't get the this alleged security that Tom Friedman talks about. I mean, Tom Friedman's the same journalist or opinion writer, columnist, who was all in favor of the Iraq War until about halfway through it. So I don't really take much of what Tom Friedman says to heart. I think I take a lot of it with a grain of salt. But I think that what Floyd was saying, I think, is more valid than what Thomas Friedman was saying. I think the American public is being taken advantage of here. We give these agencies a license to work, but work within the law. And time and again, these agencies violate the law because they think in their infinite wisdom that they think they know more than everybody else and that they can violate the law because they're worth the National Security Agency. Time and again. I mean, the Bush administration, they completely violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law by going around it. They couldn't have, I mean, there was no idea of even creating the law or changing the law. It was just violating the law. And you have, more recently, you have James Clapper, who lies in front of Congress by saying that they aren't doing any, gathering any information on Americans. And here, it turns out they're gathering everybody's telephone communication every single day. Not the content, but every single call that's being made, whether it's a grandmother in Topeka, Kansas, calling their next-door neighbor, or wherever. All that information is being stored in probably in Bluffdale when it's finished in a couple months, and being stored for 5 years. So this isn't within the boundary of what NSA was created for. It was created to prevent us from being attacked by Russia, nuclear weapons. This new idea of using it to track everybody and all that, I think, is just I've been, as you mentioned many times, I've been following it for more than 30 years, actually since my first book came out in 1982. So I've been following this, and it's morphed into this agency that it was never supposed to be. And it doesn't really do a very good job at it.
You mean we're not any safer because of the information?
We're not safer at all. I mean, it's they had this whole program of getting everybody's phone number. Well, the only thing that they were able to point to as a big success for that, and it's been going on for 7 years, was that they found somebody in San Diego that sent $8,000 to some group in Somalia, and that's it. This is not, they've been doing, like I said, this for 7 years, and much of this time they've been doing it not only on phone calls, but also on email metadata, the details of who's sending to who and what time and all that. And all during that time, we had Times Square bomber who had been communicating to Pakistan and nobody knew about him. We had the underwear bomber over Detroit Christmas Day. And that was all in Yemen. And it was in a key target area of NSA. And nobody knew about that. And then we have the Boston bombers who we were warned about by Russia and who were communicating and traveling back and forth to Chechnya and Dagestan, and they had no clue about that. So you get all this, this enormous haystack of data, and they keep building more and more data on top of it, and it makes it just all the harder to find the needle. And in addition to that, it's a total waste of money because we could be spending that money on something far more useful than NSA collecting everybody's telephone calls.
Well, this is one thing you write about. You say, because the question is just how surgical can the NSA be with this information at this point? I mean, one of the things you report is you write about a former NSA official, a William Binney, who had made a number of efforts to try to get the agency to be a little bit more strategic or surgical in the way they target the surveillance. But you write that the agency wasn't really interested in that they were really just kind of interested in storing pretty much everything as opposed to being more discriminating in that information.
Well, that's what these the people that I followed for 30 years now or whatever, you put them in this position, and the whole idea in a bureaucracy is to make it bigger and make it more powerful. And within NSA, the way you do that is by gathering more data. That makes you more powerful. It makes you bigger. It enables you to hire more people. Enables you to get more money. And that's the philosophy. Bill Binney, who was very brave and cooperating, telling me a lot about what was really going on. He was a former very senior official, unlike Ed Snowden. Binney had been there for almost 40 years, and he was the civilian equivalent of a general. He basically automated the entire NSA eavesdropping system. And when he saw it was being turned for the first time on the American public, he decided to quit after all those years. And that's what he was saying, was that the agency is basically this runaway organization that once you eliminate the once you take the leash off, basically, this is what happens. It just keeps gathering more and more bureaucratic power in the form of more and more data, more and more information. The only two restraints on NSA is the Congress and the courts. And in neither cases do they actually work. For 2.5 years, the NSA was illegally eavesdropping on American communications, a warrantless wiretapping program. The Congress did nothing about it. Either they didn't pay any attention or they didn't even care about it, but they did nothing about it. It was only the New York Times that eventually exposed it. The same thing with the court. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is a secret court that is rather useless. It doesn't really do much of anything. I think in 35 years, it's turned down maybe 10 requests out of maybe, who knows, 100,000 requests or whatever. And even when the court turns them down, there's another avenue of appeal. There's another court system that nobody's ever heard of. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Court of Review. And in 35 years, I think it's only heard one case. It's sort of the Maytag repairman of the judiciary. And then if that Foreign Intelligence Court of Review turns the government down on a request, the government has a right to an immediate in-camera ex parte, in other words, secret and one person only, one side only, appeal to the Supreme Court. So and the Roberts Court is not likely to turn them down. So, you know, the NSA, these checks and balances on the NSA are more imaginary than reality.
James Bamford is with us. He's the author of the book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping of America. He's also writing about the NSA for Wired magazine. You can find links to his writing on our webpage, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist James Bamford. He's the author of the book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. He's been covering the NSA, the National Security Agency, for more than 30 years now. I wanted to ask you, there's an email that comes from Joel who asks a question about the threat of what he calls parallel construction. Maybe you could explain what that is, this idea that they're using this NSA information for other agencies like the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Well, the NSA does a lot of sharing of this information. The NSA is only a collector. It collects information for other organizations, whether it's the Defense Department, the CIA, the State Department, whatever. So that's NSA goes out and grabs it and analyzes it and stores it and then passes it on to other organizations. So that's one of the other dangers. And it's not only organizations in the U.S. Like the DEA or whoever it is that might be, or the FBI, whoever it is that they might be interested in the data. It's also foreign governments. So whatever NSA gets, it also shares with the British and the Australians and the New Zealanders and the Canadians, and each of them can probably share it with their own internal law enforcement organizations. And now there's a fair amount of sharing also with the what they call the third parties, which are the Europeans and Japan and so forth, allies, where they gather their information, they give it to us, and then we share it with them. So that's one of the dangers here that people don't realize, is that it's not just NSA picking this up. And it is an extremely secret agency, but it's not secret with its secret partners. It shares an awful lot with its secret partners.
Last week, the Washington Post published this internal NSA audit, something they had gotten from Edward Snowden. And the report revealed thousands of privacy violations in 2011, in the first quarter of 2012. Some of these were apparently due to human error, but also there were some actual violations of laws governing surveillance. Was any of this a surprise to you in the revelation? What do you make of that?
No, I've been hearing about these basically for years, but this was the first time we'd actually seen, or anybody outside of NSA had actually seen documents that identify how many and from where and that kind of thing. What's interesting, however, is that, yeah, these were thousands of violations, and what each of these were what they call instances, each instance and so forth, mm-hmm. which each instance can be maybe 100 or 1,000 people. If they said 2,000, doesn't mean there's 2,000 people. It just means there's 2,000 incident, and each incident can be a large number of people. In addition, this was just NSA's headquarters. And most of what NSA is not at its headquarters. It has 4,000 intercept operators in the state of Georgia near Augusta, for example. It has another big group, enormous number of them, in Texas near San Antonio. Another one in Colorado, outside of Denver and Aurora, and still another in Hawaii. And that's not talking about the people in the other parts of the world. So this one was just the headquarters, and it just covered 1 year. So if you multiply that times how many other parts of NSA are outside of that area, and then over how many years, you're into a very large number of violations. Mm.
I wanted to ask you, I don't want you to take this as a facetious question. Should there be an NSA is the question. And what I mean by it is there the technology really available in order to accomplish what they say they are after? Should there be an NSA, or should, if there should, what are the parameters? What are the boundaries for the agency, do you think?
Well, you know, I've never been against having an NSA. In my second book, I've done 3 books just on NSA over the years. And in my second book, they actually had a book signing for me at NSA. I mean, they had lines of people at NSA lining up to have me sign their book. So it was a quite favorable book. I'm not always speak about having a love-hate relationship with NSA, where I love them and they hate me. But there's times when my books have been very favorable towards them. So it's the point I'm trying to make here is that I do think that there should be an NSA, and I've never said that there shouldn't be an NSA. What I say is that it should go back to its roots. Its roots are focusing on foreign communications, focus on Yemen, for example, focus on areas that where you think it might be useful. But this whole idea of bringing NSA home or turning its big ear on American people, I think, is totally out of bounds. It's not what it was designed for. It's not what the law allows, and it's useless because it doesn't really provide anything except for more cost and more loss of privacy and liberty.
Mm. One of the implications of all of this you mentioned, and you've been referring to it throughout the hour, is that there is now the capacity, you say in the Shadow Factory, you say the capacity to make tyranny total in America.
I don't actually say that. That's what Senator Frank Church, head of the Church Committee, the first investigative committee from Congress to actually look into NSA. Mm.
Didn't Benny that say that too?
Didn't Benny said something very similar. He said we're talking now about Bill Benny, who was the former senior NSA official who cooperated in my Wired article. What he said was that he held his thumb and forefinger about an inch apart from each other and said we're this close from a turnkey totalitarian state. And what he meant by that was that we aren't a totalitarian state right now. Obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be able to write these books or these articles. But he said we're that close to a turnkey totalitarian society. In other words, the infrastructure is there. The NSA has provided the infrastructure, the same infrastructure that Senator Frank Church talked about in 1975. And it's much more invasive today. And so if you got a president in there, Richard Nixon or whoever, somebody that was going to turn it not for counterterrorism purposes, but for political purposes or for whatever purposes he wants to, it's there just to turn the key. Mm. I mean, the whole thing is set up for that to happen. That's one of the reasons he left, because it wasn't supposed to be that way. That's not what the NSA was supposed to be all about. And that's what worried him, was that it's a agency that can as you can see now. I mean, they have everybody's phone calls, who's calling whom. How, it doesn't take much more effort to find out the content of all that or to get all your emails. Matter of fact, they were doing that with all the emails just up until 2011. It was only Senator Wyden and Senator Udall that objected, and NSA couldn't prove that it was doing any good, so they closed it, that operation down. So the system is there. It just hasn't had the key turned all the way on yet.
There was some hope that the Obama administration would address some of the, you know, constitutional concerns of the NSA programs. You disappointed?
Well, sure. I think the Obama administration came into office with a an agenda. The agenda was get reelected, and the way you get reelected was to take the base support for Obama, which is was the very much fairly much the liberal support, and then grab a chunk of the conservative support. And so you take the your base with you with the domestic policy, medical care and so forth, and then you get the middle to right behind you and cut the legs off your opponent, your Republican opponent, by going to the right of George Bush. And that's what he did. He tripled the number of people in Afghanistan, extended the war into a second term. He took drone warfare to you know, the ultimate extent, where he's actually even blowing up American citizens without a trial. And he's authorized the NSA to go beyond what George Bush ever did. So, yeah, he's been a bit of a disappointment.
James Bamford, the author of the book The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. Also, Body of Secrets. There are a number of books. In fact, in his writing is also found in Wired. You can find all of that. Links to it anyway on our website. James Bamford joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure, Doug. I appreciate being on your show.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.